Welcome to Kabbalah and Coffee. It's great to see everybody this morning. So I want to begin with kind of a preliminary idea about how to understand the teachings of Torah. I know that sounds very vague, but I'll tell you specifically what I have in mind. And I wrote about it in the email. So Torah speaks on a very practical and pragmatic level. When you study Torah, you'll encounter two basic forms of verses or of text. One is narrative, the story of, yesterday we started the Torah again from the beginning, from Genesis. So you have narrative, you have the story of creation, the story of the flood and Noah's Ark, you have the story of Abraham and Sarah, you have the story of Isaac and Rebecca, you have the story of Jacob and Rachel and Leah, you have the story of the 12 tribes, you have Joseph's story, you have the Egyptian slavery story, you have the Moses redemption story, the 10 plagues, the splitting of the sea, the giving of the Torah at Sinai. You have all these narratives in Torah. And then you have the journeys of the Jewish people throughout the 40 years of the in the wilderness, and that's again narrative in nature. So that's one form of Torah. And then there's one style, if you will. And then there's another style in Torah, and that is the legalistic, where you get into the laws. The first law that we have, the first mitzvah, was given to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And what was the mitzvah? Peru revu, be fruitful and multiply. Right? It's make more people. We need more people in this. You can't do it alone. So make more people. That's the first mitzvah. And then Adam gets a few other mitzvot. Noah gets mitzvot. Famously, between Adam and Noah, there are 7 commandments. And the way we understand this is that these commandments, these 7 core commandments, are applicable to all humankind, whereas the rest of the Torah is specifically for the Jewish people. But 7 core mitzvot are applicable to all human beings. So we have certain mitzvot, but the commandment style of Torah really picks up when, in the context of the Exodus and its aftermath and the giving of the Torah, that's when we find suddenly lots of rules and regulations. Do this, don't do that, observe this holiday, these are the offerings of this holiday, the 10 commandments at Sinai, obviously we have a lot of do's and don'ts. So the point is like this. A lot of Torah is narrative. A lot of Torah tells story. A lot of Torah is instructive, telling us how to live, what to do, and what not to do. That's a very general overview of the style of Torah. Now, within that, there are 2 ways that you can study Torah. One way is by looking at Torah and the verses on a very practical, physical, literal level. Story of creation, literally. Abraham and Sarah, real people who really practiced hospitality. They really lived in ancient times, and they had a tent, and they invited people in, and they taught them about monotheism. That's what they did. And Isaac, and the binding of Isaac on the mountain, and Rebekah, his wife, and all the story, Moses, and Pharaoh, and plagues. And all of the mitzvot. Honor your parents, and don't kill, and don't steal. I'm just going through some 10 commandments stuff, right? All of these commandments, practical, physical commandments given to us, human beings living on planet Earth. That's one way we can understand Torah, and that's 100% legit. That's the first approach that we have in Torah study. And then our sages open up our eyes to another dimension of Torah study, not to take away from the pragmatic dimension, but they reveal other dimensions of Torah study. And that is, that although Torah speaks in very practical terms, both in the narrative part of Torah and in the laws of Torah, practical human beings doing this or that or the other, and this is what you should do and what you should not do. Although it speaks in very practical, pragmatic, physical terms, there's also a way to study Torah that is a little bit more abstract. And when I say abstract, I don't mean that it wouldn't be relevant to us ultimately, but what I mean is it's not so much about, for example, one ox goring another ox, but it's about what happens when my animal soul gets into some sort of conflict with your animal soul. So what do we do then? What do we do when our lower instincts are kind of bumping up against each other? In other words, there's a way to understand Torah to not only speak on a very physical level, but also in a spiritual dimension. And so our sages tell us that although Torah speaks on the lowest physical plane of existence, it alludes to another entire narrative on a higher, loftier spiritual dimension. So Torah speaks down here, but it hints to truths that exist up here. And when I say up here, it's obviously not physical, I mean in the spiritual realms. And not only about the secrets of creation, but also speaking to our spiritual lives. So it's not just, like I said before, one ox goring another ox, or two people fighting over a talis, over a garment, each one claiming ownership of it for themselves. But it's also about, for example, two people that do a mitzvah, and their souls, each two people are involved in the same mitzvah, and their souls on some level are claiming ownership of that mitzvah. That's a way to understand a physical example of conflict, fighting over one garment. That's how to understand it in a spiritual sense. Every mitzvah is a garment for the soul, and two people fighting over a garment means that two souls on a spiritual level are fighting over one mitzvah. Although you would think that souls would be selfless, like you take the mitzvah. But nonetheless, a soul could say, no, I did this mitzvah, and I appreciate your efforts, but it was me, and whatever. So the point is like this. Torah is multifaceted. And Torah can be understood on multiple dimensions. And although it might appear that Torah is only speaking of the very pragmatic, Torah is also speaking of the spiritual. I think it was the Shalah. I could be wrong, though. There was a mystic who lived a few hundred years ago who wrote something absolutely incredible. He flipped everything in reverse. And he writes that Torah speaks of higher realities and hints to the lower realities. He flips it. The way we typically understand it is that Torah speaks down here to the physical, but it hints, if you know how to look at it, it also hints to spiritual truths. But this Kabbalist says, no, it's the contrary. Torah speaks most immediately to the spiritual and only hints to the physical. So when you're studying a story about Abraham and Sarah, it's not, the literal story is almost like what you have to learn into it. It's most directly speaking of a spiritual truth. And when you encounter a mitzvah like we're going to do today, we're going to study a very dark mitzvah. It's a mitzvah, dark piece of Jewish law in Torah and Deuteronomy. There's two ways to look at it. Either it's a physical case that has a spiritual application, or it's a spiritual discussion that also has a physical application. So this Kabbalist flips it on its head. It's not that Torah primarily speaks down here, but also can be understood up here. Torah primarily speaks up here, and it can also be understood down here. What's the difference? It's a matter of perspective. What's the primary aim of Torah? It's really both. It's to guide us in our practical lives and to inform our spiritual lives. So, I mean, I think both are true. It's just an interesting way to look at it. Does Torah begin below above or above below? And the way we understand Torah, essentially coming from Hashem, coming from God, it would make most sense that it would first speak to the spiritual stuff and then filter down to the physical as well. So with that in mind, let us jump into the discussion. Okay. It's a bit intense for a Sunday morning. Yeah, well, no, you'll see what I mean. But this is our discussion today. It's our discussion because it was in last week's. For those that were here last week, remember, if you recall, I skipped the brackets just to finish the thought of the chapter. And this was contained in the brackets, and I think it's a very powerful message here, and I wanted to begin with this. Okay, so a few relevant points. So number one, in Jewish law, there are three cardinal sins. Now, why are they called cardinal sins? So I don't know what cardinal means in the English. What does cardinal mean? What's cardinal sin? Primary? It doesn't mean if you really want to get something good, start with these three. It's not what it, no, cardinal sins in this sense, not a top three list. Cardinal sin in the sense, good morning, means in Jewish law as clarified in the Talmud and Maimonides and all the great codifiers of Jewish law, it's like this. In most situations of Jewish law, the law is that if someone's life is threatened due to the observance of that law, you do not observe the law, you rather preserve a life. The Torah says, regarding the mitzvot, v'chai bahem, you should live with the mitzvot. You should live with Torah and mitzvot. The way our sages understood this, not only does it mean that our lives should be infused with Torah values and the mitzvot, but it means that the performance of Torah and mitzvot should not come at the expense of your life. So if it's life and death, violate the law. Break the law. Give you a pragmatic example in, let's say, American law. Somebody, God forbid, needs to get to the hospital. It's an emergency. And the driver of the car approaches a red light. What would you tell the driver to do? Stop at the red light? Or look carefully, make sure no one's there, and gun it, and take the light? Or, obviously, saving a life. We'll say with Talmudic sing-song, right? You're breaking the law. The law is suspended in cases of life and death. On Shabbos, the law clearly says you violate Shabbat, you break Shabbos to save a life. In fact, the Talmud discusses a case, God forbid, if a building collapses. Now, buildings still collapse today, tragically, but you can imagine 1,500 years ago, without building code and who knows what, how, who, where, when was building, what they were building with, buildings were collapsing. So the Talmud discusses a case where a building collapses and you don't know if somebody might be trapped inside. So it's not even a case of life and death. It's a question of maybe saving a life. You don't even know. You're allowed to violate Shabbat and do whatever it takes to clear the rubble, to see if somebody's inside. So what I'm trying to say is not only is Shabbos, it's not even considered to be a violation of Shabbos. It's kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Superseded? Is that a good word? Yeah. It's not only that Shabbos is superseded in cases of life and death, it's you supersede Shabbos even if it's a question that maybe it's a matter of life and death. So a very practical application of this is when it comes to childbirth. So even though childbirth is not necessarily automatically a life and death situation, Jewish law understands it to be in on the level of sakana. Sakana means danger, potentially life-threatening danger. Like if a woman is in labor and she's ready to give birth, and there's no doctor around, she's not in a hospital, whatever it is, to try that at home or to attempt some sort of, obviously these things happen and you always hear these stories about, somebody delivering a baby accidentally, they were on the phone with whatever it is. But like, ideally, you're in the right, in a proper context. So the way it's understood in halacha, certainly today, is that that's considered to be something potentially life-threatening, and therefore you absolutely will violate Shabbat, will supersede. It's not considered a violation. The reason why I make that clarification is because violation makes it sound like you've broken Shabbat. But you can't break it if it says to save a life. If Shabbat itself says save a life, then you're not breaking it, you're listening to it. In other words, God says keep Shabbat, but not if it's life-threatening. So then you're not violating Shabbat. You're superseding Shabbat, or you're But you're not violating it. So I just want to clarify. I've had a few stories with our children, Shabbat, which I'll share in just a moment. Yeah.
But I was wondering if in Judaism, if there's a choice between a mother and a child. Oh. A child, where
yeah.
does the Torah stand?
Yeah. The Talmud actually speaks of abortion in that context. The Talmud says if a woman is in labor and her life is threatened due to the fetus, you abort the fetus to save the mother's life. The Talmud says the mother's life comes first. It doesn't say when the child is born. If the child is born, then I think it's a more difficult question. You know, how do you measure the value of an infant versus an adult? I don't know that Jewish law would have a way to decide that.
But once the child is born, it's a separate entity.
Correct.
You don't have to choose unless you were killing a child that was somehow terribly deformed.
No, no, I understand your question, but I guess the question, if we can conceive of a scenario where only one can live, and it's a parent and a child, or an adult and a child, I don't know that Jewish law provides any framework for figuring that out, and I don't think there's any, you know, Sophie's Choice, the movie Sophie's Choice.
Well, I wasn't even going that far.
I'm just saying, so once we have, but the question of a mother and a fetus, the Talmud straight up discusses and says you abort the fetus. 100%. You abort the fetus to save the life of the mother. Now, the commentaries, the Talmud doesn't give the rationale. The commentaries, famously Rashi and Rambam, Rashi, the famous commentary, biblical and Talmudic commentary, and Maimonides, they each provide a different rationale for this ruling. I think it's... Rashi says, because the fetus is not a full life, whereas the mother is a full life. So when you have a non-full life pitted against the full life, so the non-full life, the full life takes precedence. Maimonides says a very interesting rationale, different rationale. He says it has to do with the laws of Rodef. The laws of Rodef are if somebody is a pursuer of life, in other words, if somebody is threatening someone else's life, then you're allowed to take that life to save the life. Does that make sense? If somebody, if God forbid, you know, somebody is chasing somebody with a knife or a gun, a third party is allowed to stop that person, the assailant, potential murderer, even if it's required, using lethal force, so that they don't take the life of an innocent person.
But then you happen to mention the Sophie's Choice question, and that brings in a whole
nother. Yeah, that's a whole nother. So according to Maimonides, that's why the fetus, even though it's not aware, and it's not intentional, and it's not doing that on purpose, but Maimonides says it's a din rodef. Since it's endangering the mother's life, it's the one that's posing the danger to the mother's life. So therefore, you're allowed to abort in that situation. Anyway, that law and these rationales, Rashi and Maimonides, when I tell you what the ramifications are, I mean that's we've had a whole 90-minute sessions. Just on this one area of Jewish law, because it affects so much of a discussion today with regards to, you know, what Jewish law would say about what can or should or whatever can be done with regards to these cases. But that we'll have to leave that as a separate discussion for a separate time. Getting back to this core idea. So I'll tell you the stories. So Nassan, my oldest, who's actually in town now and going back to Chicago tomorrow morning, please God. So Nassan was born on a Friday night. So Leah was in labor, I think, from like Thursday night, and then Friday night she was, you know, was getting more serious. And the doctor said, you know, if this or this happened, you know, if the contractions are at a certain, you know, frequency and whatever it is, then you got to go to the hospital. Hey, good morning. So it's Friday night. We're living in Brooklyn, in Crown Heights. In like Chabad, like super Chabad neighborhood area. It was super Chabad. It's the Chabad headquarters hangout. And she has to go to the hospital. So I'm like, all right, we're doing this. Pick up the phone. And I call a car service. We didn't have a car. Who has a car in Brooklyn? I mean, people do, but like, we didn't have a car. So I called the car service. And they're like, and you have to understand, for me, growing up, you know, I grew up with Shabbat and not, you know, not making phone calls on Shabbat. That's how I grew up. This is the first time I'm picking up the phone on Shabbat and making a phone call Friday night. So I make the call. And wouldn't you know it, we have no cars available. So I'm like, all right, second phone call. Let's do this. Might as well. I had to call a second car service. Finally got a car, and we got to the hospital. And I spoke to a rabbi proficient in these laws, and he said that I'm allowed to ride in the elevator with Leah, because even though my life is not, like, she obviously would be able to ride an elevator and not have to schlep upstairs in Brooklyn Methodist Hospital in Park Slope. Like, she obviously doesn't have to, like, in labor, schlep upstairs. You know, it's dangerous. But what about me? Thank God I was okay. You know, I wasn't having a child. Good morning, good morning. So the Rav said that since for her, it's reassuring, and it's emotionally, like, it's an important thing that her husband is there. So he says definitely ride with her. And so you see how halacha takes all these factors into, how Jewish law takes all these factors into account. So this is true regarding, out of the 613 commandments, this is true regarding 610 of the commandments. A full 610, if it's life or death, you supersede the mitzvah? No. Yeah. A full 610, you supersede the mitzvah to save a life. You don't worry about the mitzvah, make sure everyone's okay. Three exceptions. Three cardinal sins. Murder, idolatry, and an illicit relationship. These are three exceptions to that law. Now, we'll get into these exceptions in a moment. The question, though, is why are these exceptions? The typical understanding, when I say typical, the general consensus is that when it comes to these three sins, they so violate the contract, if you will, of the fabric of life itself, at least from a Torah perspective, that you don't preserve life for that. Like, what's life after, like, how? So what are these three? So number one, murder. For example, if somebody says, we're going to have three parties here, so A, B, and C. If A says to B, kill C, or I'll kill you, Mr. B, is B allowed to kill C? No. What? So murder is a prohibition. You can't kill. You're not a murderer. But it's saving a life. It's preserving your own life. But you can't preserve your life while killing someone else. You can preserve your life and violate Shabbat. You can preserve your life and whatever it is. But you can't preserve your life by taking someone else's life.
But you can preserve someone else's life. You can take someone else's life to preserve another.
Right, because then it's not considered murder. It's considered self-defense. Although the person, right, like I said before, about the pursuer of life, at that point, the pursuer of life has also violated the very fabric of their contract of humanity, which is not to take a life. And so therefore, paradoxically, whatever, so therefore you can take their life, but it's not really taking a life, it's stopping, it's protecting an innocent life. Yeah, it's a very interesting, the laws of Rodev are very interesting, and it also plays into, you know, there was discussion after 9/11, what if we knew that a plane was going to be directed. Let's say we knew that it was going to the World Trade Center. Let's say we had an intel and it was headed there. Do you shoot the plane out of the sky? How many people died in the World Trade Center? 3,000? Yeah. 3,000, yeah. Plus. How many were on the plane? I know, I'm not saying it's a numbers game, but let's just talk it out. How many were on the plane? 200, 300 maybe, max? Okay. So here's a question that a government might consider. Right? It's not even might. I'm sure it's been discussed since 9/11. What would you do? What would you do? What would you want your government to do? If you were in charge, what would you decide? How would you set policy? God forbid. It should never happen. But what would you do? It's headed straight for a tower with thousands of people. And you could, let's say, theoretically, you can shoot the plane out of the sky and not have any other casualties on the ground. There are terrorists on the plane, but there are also, innocent lives. Do you take those innocent lives to save those innocent lives? Or do you say, who says you can take one of the, let things play out? We can't. Jewish law might say, I'm not saying for sure, it might say that the plane is a rodef. We said before that a rodef doesn't have to be intentional, doesn't have to be malicious, doesn't have to be, right? A rodef is just a pragmatic situation where at this point, this person's situation is posing a threat to innocent life. One may be allowed by the laws of rodef to eliminate the pursuer of life. Rodef literally means a chaser, a runner, running after, pursuing someone else's life. In which case, halachically, it might be okay to shoot at a plane. Some say no, it's not, based on other factors of rodef. But again, these laws are so intricate and so complex. But I'm just bringing up that you asked about pursuing life. There's a lot of practical ramifications of how Jewish law might look at very potentially real-time discussions of situations. Now, so we once had a discussion about this in a class. This is going back probably 6 or 7, maybe even 8 years. There was a fellow at the class who said that you wouldn't believe it. His father, I think in Toronto, his father was a survivor of the Holocaust. And after the war, and he was a psychologist, I don't know if he became a psychologist afterwards, whatever it is, he practiced psychology in Toronto. And there happened to be a lot of survivors in Toronto, and a lot of them came to him. It was a younger man who came to him, and he was just absolutely filled with guilt. I don't even want to say this story. But anyway, he was faced with this. A Nazi went to him and said, take a life or I will kill you. And he took that life. I don't bring this up in any way to judge or to... No, that's not why I'm bringing this up. I'm just telling you that this is not a theoretical scenario. This has happened. And people have made various choices. I'll tell you what Jewish law says, but again, I'm just telling you, it's even worse, the story. I left out an important detail. It wasn't just a random person, it was a family member. Whatever. I'm not going to get into more details in this, but just understand, this person, was the rest of their lives, was just couldn't live with himself. Whatever it is, but Torah, it's not whatever it is, but I don't want to dismiss it, but it's not, again, it's not the direct focus. So, just getting back, the Torah says, in general, break the law, save a life, but not if you're taking a life. Also not if you're serving idols. Idolatry, Avodah Zarah, the prohibition against idolatry, is huge in Judaism. It's the first and second commandments of the Ten Commandments. And again, even if it doesn't necessarily resonate on our, you know, top list of things, like, it's a big deal, I bow down to a little statue, like, who got hurt in this process? Nonetheless, Jewish law considers it to be a very big thing. And it says that if God forbid, a person is faced with this choice, rather give up, what's the choice? Either bow down to the idol or, God forbid, be killed, a person should rather be willing to give up their life than to serve the idol. Historically, millions of Jews, I don't have an exact number, but countless Jews have made this choice, the ultimate sacrifice of, not that they took their own lives, but they said, do what you will, but I will not abdicate my faith. I will not give up my identity. I will not, you know, bow down to some sort of foreign entity. I'm going to stay true to who I am. You do whatever you want or whatever it is, but I will not violate that. And again, that's what Jewish law prescribes. The third is called Gilei Arayos, which means illicit relationships, which primarily refers to the idea of adultery. And so here we have this idea that Torah talks about this type of illicit relationship as something that is, number one, possibly a capital offense, and number two, something that one ought to be willing to give up their life rather than to violate. Now, The Torah then discusses some specifics of this latter case. And it says like this. Again, remember one other critical point. When the Torah talks about capital crimes, so the Torah prescribes for certain things, for example, murder or idolatry or illicit relationships, it provides for, it says that the consequence of that, it says that it's a capital crime. Now, it doesn't mean that in all cases it would produce that type of outcome. Because the laws, Jewish court law, the justice system, is very rigorous in how cases are adjudicated and how crimes or whatever it is are prosecuted. And the burden of prosecution is very, very high in Jewish law. We've discussed this in our comparative legal courses, but just know this, that the Talmud says that if the Jewish court, the Sanhedrin, put even one person to death in 70 years, it was considered to be a court that had blood in its hand, like a bloodthirsty court, because it was so rare that a crime should, with the high burden of proof and evidence and witness. In Jewish law, even confession is non-admissible. I don't know how well known that is. If somebody says, I did it, it's inadmissible in court, in Jewish law. Somebody says, I did it. Somebody says that they, God forbid, are the murderer. You throw it out. It doesn't mean you let them back on the streets necessarily. You know, there's other things that can be done, but it's inadmissible. That testimony, that self-incrimination is inadmissible in a court of law. The only admissible evidence in a Jewish court, witnesses. Two witnesses that witnessed it with their own eyes and that can attest to exactly what happened. Not only that, but in order to be liable, in order to find someone guilty and actually punish them in a capital way, in capital punishment, there has to be not only witnesses seeing the capital crime, but the witnesses have to warn the perpetrator verbally. Say, you're not allowed to do that. The perpetrator has to hear the warning and acknowledge that they heard the warning and say, but I'm still doing it anyway. You understand how high this burden is. It doesn't mean that in Jewish law you let criminals roam the streets necessarily, although prison system does not exist in Jewish law. We're having a course, actually, a six-week course on Jewish criminal law coming up in February. So in a few more... Yeah?
Is it Jewish criminal law based on 1,000 years ago?
Oh, no.
Or based on today?
No, not today. Not today. No. This is not Israeli law. No. This is ancient... This is Jewish law, biblical, Talmudic Jewish law. Now, this is original Jewish law. No. Today, what the courts in America have, and the Israeli court system is based on what we would call secular law, not Torah law. It's based on modern forms of law in the United States, in Britain, and other forms. That's how Israeli law exists. Yeah, no. Thanks for asking. When I talk about Jewish law now, in this discussion, Jewish law is not modern Israeli law. This is Torah law as explained in the Talmud and etc. So the burden of proof is extremely high. So I'm going to say once in 70 years, I mentioned, would be considered a bloody court. Anyway, okay. But the point is that by highlighting the fact that it's a capital crime, it highlights the severity of the situation. So the Torah talks about a situation where a married or betrothed is... Okay, we'll keep it simple. There's two steps of a Jewish wedding. Typically today, they're done at the same time. In the chuppah ceremony, you're doing both the kiddushin and the nisuyin. These are two steps of the Jewish marriage. Two steps are done pretty much at the same time. But in ancient times, sometimes it was done a year apart. It's not really an engagement and then a wedding. It's more like a betrothal and then a wedding and then the full wedding. But the point is like this. The Torah talks about if a man and a woman, they're married, if they're together, etc., then again, it's a capital crime. Then the Torah talks about another situation. And this is what our, the text of our handout. Could you pass one down to Maritza, please? Pass one, if you don't mind, one of those copies down to your left. Thank you. Here we go. The Torah here, so again, the Torah first presents a situation where the man and the woman, right, they're married, not to each other, that capital crime. But here we go. If a man finds a maiden in the field, and the man overpowers her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die. This is a non-consensual situation. We don't consider it on her part, obviously. Probably goes without saying, but the Torah spells it out. It's not considered as though she participated in any sort of illicit relationship if she was assaulted. And the example that it uses is in a remote location. Only the man who lay with her shall die. In other words, the crime is his alone. To the girl you shall do nothing. The girl did not commit a sin deserving of death. For just as a man rises up against his fellow and murders him, so is this case. You have clearly, you don't have two participants in this action. You have one person that has victimized the other. Just like, God forbid, if somebody rises against, the Torah literally uses an analogy, right? Since when is Torah giving us analogies? Just like when if a person, God forbid, were to rise against his fellow, to murder him, there's clearly the wrongdoer and the innocent victim. So too it is in this case of the young woman in the field who was assaulted. For the maiden was found in the field. She cried out, but there was no one to save her. And again, it's given a scenario where this assault, this horrific assault, could happen doesn't mean that's the only place it could happen, but it's giving a scenario where no one's there to help her, no one's there to hear her cries because it was in a remote location in a field.
Then there's no witnesses either.
Right, and that's why I said that when the Torah talks about a sin deserving of death, it doesn't necessarily mean that this person will be actually executed by the court. It may not, the evidence may not rise to that, but that person is guilty of a capital crime. And Jewish law, Torah law, believes that God, that justice, if the courts can't do justice, then God figures out a way to do justice. Things don't go uncompensated, if you will. So, but again, it's highlighting that you're right. Alone in a field, so who are the witnesses now? And so do you let this guy walk? Like I said before, in ancient times, Jewish law prescribes, it talks about a king. And the king, if the king feels like something happened, the king can create his own decrees as a king, not in the court. You see, there's different branches of the Jewish, government, but whatever, structure as well, where you have the courts, and then you have a king. And the king was able to do things that, even if the courts couldn't do something, the king could certainly do something. So whatever the king would do, that would be a discretionary thing. But this person would not be just, oh, well, I guess we don't have any witnesses, so then just, roam. That wouldn't happen. But the point is, you're right. They might not be executed by the court, but the Torah is highlighting the severity of this act. And again, very importantly, it's describing how she is not, again, it goes without saying. You know what? I don't know if it goes without saying. I'm actually gonna step back on that. Okay. Because I've read reports that come out of foreign countries, and when a young woman is assaulted, sometimes she is blamed and she is marked for shame, and she is somehow something or other, right? She is victimized further based on this original victimization. I think this Torah law, this verse, to me, when the Torah analogizes and says, for just as a man rises up against his fellow and murders him, so is this case. You would never blame a murder victim. It wouldn't be like, oh, you got murdered. You're also part of that. Like, you know, I think this is a very, what?
You don't have any evidence because you have no DNA. So then a week later she says and he says.
Oh, yeah, listen, I'm not.
I'm not arguing.
No, I understand that. But I'm saying the general perspective. Let's say, listen, God knows what happened, right? So the question is, so what are the, if it happened, right? It's not if it happens. Yeah, it says if a man, yeah. So saying, if this happens, forget about how we know if it happens. If this happens, what has happened? This man has absolutely assaulted this young woman, and it's similar to a situation where somebody murders someone else. There's a clear wrongdoer, a clear perpetrator, and a clear victim, and we can't confuse the two, whatever, etc. And again, so that's how the Torah lays it out. And I'm only emphasizing this point because I caught myself saying that it's obvious, and then I was saying, well, yeah, it's kind of obvious, and then I realized it's not so obvious. Even today, it's not so obvious, right? It's not so obvious. I think it's very powerful that the Torah, literally, Deuteronomy, this is not the Talmud, 1,500, 1,700 years ago, this is Deuteronomy, 3,300 years ago, when who knows what was going on back then in society at large, right? Right? 3,300 years ago is drawing those clear lines of distinction between right and wrong, or between guilty party and victim. Okay. The reason why we're bringing this up is because, like I mentioned before, it was in the brackets that we skipped last week, and it's a powerful teaching. Because, like I said at the top of the class, every piece of Torah could be understood in a very practical sense, and it can also be understood in a spiritual sense. There's a way to understand these three verses in Deuteronomy chapter 22, verses 25 through 27. There's a way to understand these verses in a completely spiritual fashion. Not speaking about a physical assault at all. Now, understand this. What we're about to do is study the Torah in a sense, not exactly, but study the Torah like they study it in heaven. Divorced of the practical, physical actions or discussion. How would you study this on a spiritual level? But that in no way takes away from the literal meaning, the literal law, the literal perspective that the Torah shares with us about that horrific potential scenario that actually happens in this physical world. In addition to that, there's another way to understand this. Again, not taking away from that, but adding on to that. So in Hebrew, certain words are masculine and certain words are feminine. So in Hebrew grammar, in English, if you are speaking to someone and you say the word you, there's no feminine form, from what I understand, there's no feminine form of you. You is neutral, right? Now, he and she are obviously gender specific, but you is not gender specific. In Hebrew, you have a little bit more specificity. And there's a lot of words that in English, a lot of nouns, there are a lot of words in Hebrew that in English would not be gender specific, that in Hebrew are gender specific. One word that is gender specific, female, feminine, gender specific. Fascinating. Is neshama. Neshama means soul. Neshama, soul, is feminine. It's a feminine. It's a feminine word. A lot of words that have the hey at the end in Hebrew, they're written with a hey at the end, indicates that it's a feminine word. Neshama has a hey at the end. It's a feminine word. The soul is feminine. Why is the soul feminine? Many different ways to understand it. One thing is for sure, King Solomon, in his famous work, Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, talks about just a very passionate love between a man and a woman. And it's understood not to just be a work of romance, it's understood to talk about the relationship between God and the soul. God being, in this case, in this context, in the story of Solomon, God being, in Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, God being the man and the soul being the woman. But that's just an example of a case where the soul is very literally spoken of in the feminine. But in general, a soul, a neshama, is understood. The word and the concept of a neshama is understood in a very feminine sense. We've had classes before. We've had even an entire series of Kabbalah and Coffee where we've spoken about the difference between masculine energy and feminine energy, and not necessarily men and women specifically, because every human being has both energies. Every human men have a neshama, which is a feminine, the feminine divine sparks. A soul that is called feminine. Both men and women have a neshama, so it's not gender specific. Men, women, it's masculine. The more accurate way to describe it would be masculine and feminine, which both men and women have both traits. There are masculine traits and feminine traits, and Kabbalah extensively speaks about the distinction. In the context of the Sefirot, if you're familiar with the various Sefirot, so you have Zah and Malchus. Zah are the six Sefirot, Chesed, Gvura, Tferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod. Those are considered the masculine energies. Malchut is considered to be a feminine energy. So you have this interplay between the masculine and the feminine. And famously, we've spoken about how Malchut, although it's the last of the ten Sefirot, it's the one that actually produces the most. It's the one that actually, at the end of one world, it's the malchut of that world that produces the next world. Just like the feminine has the feminine capacity is one of birth, as opposed to the masculine capacity. So malchut, which is feminine, can give birth. And the lowest, malchut, which is the tenth of the ten sefirot, is actually rooted in the highest origin, in the highest source, which is why it has the power of birth, which is something that is so phenomenal. So like the earth, for example, Kabbalah speaks of the earth. The earth is also feminine. So the earth is something that we all walk on, and yet it's got growth in it. So it's the highest, even though it appears to, whatever. So here's the point. The point is that the neshama is spoken of in the feminine. The neshama is a feminine word. So our soul is considered to be a piece of God, spoken of using the language of femininity. So when the Torah speaks of an assault on a young maiden in the field, on a spiritual level, not to take away from the physical level, on a spiritual level, what we're talking about is a spiritual assault. It's a spiritual assault. It means when the forces, and I don't mean to sound too esoteric, we can translate it in a very practical way spiritually, it means when the forces of this world conspire to bring down the soul spirit that exists within you and I. It's when you and I are faced or inundated with challenges that threaten to suffocate what it is that we hold most dearly, what it is that we believe in. So we have our values. We have the things, our spiritual truths. We have the things that we believe in, that we profess, that we know in our heart of hearts is the most important. And then We go to work, and our boss tells us, I need you to take that report and modify it. And you say, that goes against my system of ethics. But your job is on the line. That's a spiritual assault. Or when you're when you're praying, when you're trying to speak with God, and it's praying, tefillah is the hardest thing. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. If you've ever been to a synagogue and felt like, what am I doing here? That's because prayer is absolutely the most difficult thing to pull off. I don't mean it's difficult necessarily to, you know, to sing the tunes or to whatever it is, or to stand there with a book, but I mean to really pray, to really daven, which is not even about saying words. It is about saying words also, but it's about communicating with, it's feeling that at that point in time, you are communicating and connecting with Hashem. To really feel that, the Talmud says, the Torah says, the Talmud quotes the Torah says, serve God with your heart. The Talmud says, how do you serve God with your heart? With my hand, I can give charity. I can light a candle. I can wrap tefillin. Right? I can do mitzvahs with many parts of my body. But how am I serving God with my heart? What am I doing with my heart? The Talmud says, prayer. Ezehu, or Ezehi avodah shebelev, what is service of the heart? Tefillah, prayer. If we're not feeling it, if we're not feeling the connection, we're not praying 100% right. I don't mean that as a criticism. I mean, prayer, let's speak about it in the context of a challenge. Prayer is the most, in my opinion, it's the most challenging thing to get right. Not to say the words or to read the words or to sing the songs or to stand there or to participate in a service, but to really feel at that moment connected with Hashem in a conversation, soul-felt conversation, heartfelt conversation, the most difficult. And so you're trying to pray. You're trying to get it right. Not even get it right. You're trying to get one moment of connection. To have, if a service lasts a half an hour, an hour, 2 hours, to try to get the whole time connected, that's a very lofty thing. But even for a moment, for one moment to feel, I got it. I made a connection. Because even one connection, one moment can last for an eternity. But one connection, just try to get, and the whole time, you're being assailed in your own mind. Your own mind is feeding you distracting thoughts. Right? Up, how are the Braves going to pull this off? Up, how are the Falcons going to beat those mighty Steelers? No, I'm joking. Right? How's my Bitcoin doing? How's the stocks doing? How's what's work? What's happening at home? Like, all of this stuff. The constant narrative in your mind, taking you away from that space of heart connection. That's an assault on the soul. That's a spiritual assault. And we're our own perpetrators. I don't mean that in a... I don't mean to accuse anyone. It's not our fault. God gave us this animal soul that schleps us down. It's an evil inclination. We didn't create ourselves this way, but it's a reality. The point is, when the Torah speaks of a soul... Sorry, when the Torah speaks of a young woman who's betrothed, the soul is married to God in the field, in a susceptible place, in a dangerous place. And she's being assaulted. We're talking about also, in a spiritual level, we're talking about the reality that you and I live with on a constant basis, which is trying to do the right thing, trying to feel the right thing in a world that keeps on, number one, distracting us, but more than that, trying to pull us into negative places, into bad decisions. So it's either voices inside our own heads, it could be voices outside, it could be people, it could be culture, society as a whole, just kind of like the messages of society. It could be a specific, who knows? All of the above. This is how Kabbalah, this is how Jewish mystical and spiritual teachings reveal another dimension of this, of this case of Deuteronomy 22:25-27. It's the soul who's being assaulted. And the tragedy is that sometimes it feels like there's no one that can save her. The soul can feel alone, and there's no one around. A person might be struggling and feel there's no one here to help me. No one, either physically, they don't have a support system, or they feel like even those that are around them can't understand what they're going through. But the bottom line is, this is the anguish of a soul, of a human being, who feels like their soul is being assailed, and they don't have any, there's no help. I quoted the Hebrew words of this last phrase. You see that in the text? See the Hebrew? This I centered it. Ki basade matza tza'aka hanayra hamayras. It's actually interesting. The translation here is not 100%. It says, for the maiden was found in the field, she cried out. Maybe it is right. No, yeah, no, it is right. Kibasada matzah, she's found in the field. Tzaka hanayra hamayrasa, she cried out. Ve'em moshi Allah, but there was no one to save her. It's not just a case of physical assault. It's a case of spiritual assault. And here's where Kabbalah turns everything on its head. You know, there's a phrase that says, when you're down to nothing, God's up to something. When you're down to nothing, God's up to something. And that's something that we believe in. We believe that even when things seem very bleak and things seem hopeless, there's still some, not still some, but God can help. And I don't know that they took that phrase from here, but it's certainly the way Kabbalah understands this verse. Some of you may be familiar with the term Yesh Me'ayin. Yesh Me'ayin. When Kabbalah speaks of creation, it says that all of existence that is tangible, that is Yesh, Yesh means is, it exists, it all comes Me'ayin, from nothingness. Who's the nothing? When we say Yesh Me'ayin, something from nothing, who's the nothing? God. Now, why do we call God nothing? That doesn't sound nice. When we say nothing, we mean nothing tangible. So there's all of this tangible existence, Yesh, all of this stuff that's coming Me'ayin, from non-physical reality, from the non-physical, tangible reality of God. Ayin, therefore, which means nothingness, is also a euphemism for God. So here's what Kabbalah says. If you know the Hebrew letters, you'll see this in the text. Ki basada matzah, for she was found in the field. Tzaka hanayra hamarasa, she cried out. Ve'ayin moshiela, and only God can save her. This means is, when a person has exhausted all other avenues of help, when a person has exhausted, spiritually, has exhausted all other avenues of salvation, I thought this person was going to help, or that thing, or this one, or that. When you've exhausted all of the other alternatives, and then you say, you know what, God, it's up to you now. I've tried everything in my power. You are the only one that can help. The Torah promises ve'ayin, the nothingness, which again, it's not nothing, it's God, Not Ayin is a euphemism for Hashem. The Ayin Moshiela, God will be the one to help. This is a powerful idea. Because it speaks to a soul's connection to God that is absolutely unbreakable, which is a theme that we spoke about heavily in chapter 7. The soul is so connected with God that no matter where it's been, no matter where it is currently, no matter what is plaguing the soul, no matter what is afflicting the soul, no matter what is assailing and assaulting the soul, whether it's from outside or even from inside, the soul has a peace at its core that is always, always completely retains its complete integrity and its complete wholeness and remains connected with God to the point that V'ayin Moshiela, that God, that if a person taps into that space of the soul, and that person can refine their spiritual, not even integrity, but their spiritual nobility. Make sense? Sort of. Yes.
How does it still get resolved? The person who went to the psychologist and said, "I chose to live, and my family member died." It seems like if he had chosen to die,
right,
well, his spiritual nobility would have been preserved because he would.
Right.
So
you're saying, having made that choice, how does one? You're saying, how does one come back from that? And that's an extreme case. And I guess we might say that if it doesn't work in the extreme case, then it can't be true. We spoke a few weeks ago about the concept of lost souls, and one of the major ideas that we said then in that class was that there is no such thing as a lost soul. There can't be a thing as a lost soul because the soul at its core is always connected with God. I would say even in that case, there's a part of the soul that's still connected. And at some point, I don't know.
At some point, because of that connection and that ability to be aware of that connection, that I think you begin to find peace even in that scenario. I made a decision, and I did the best that I could at that point in time. Hashem, forgive me. And help me do good and pay it forward at this point in some fashion.
Without undoing it.
Right, because you can't undo it.
Right, and
at least I can make something better of what I did
And I think for me, like the message here is with V'ayin Moshiela, no one else, the psychologist can't help this person. What are you going to say? I'm not saying that for sure can't, but like.
Doesn't help either. You go to a psychologist, to
Right, and that's really the point. Right, so it's what's someone else going to tell you? There's nothing that anyone else can tell you to make this better. But if the person finds a connection with God, whatever that means for them, to resume a life of purpose, like what Danielle said, to resume a life of purpose and meaning, despite what they've done. I'm not saying that makes it better and that repairs it and that fixes it on a cosmic level. What I'm just saying is that's a way for the soul to move forward, to continue being.
So you said when you get so low that you can't go any lower, Hashem will come to save you or to...
I don't know if it's automatic. The catchphrase was, when you're down to nothing, God's up to something. And I can't vouch for the, you know. Yeah, well, I mean, it's a phrase. But I didn't mean it in the literal context. That's a phrase that's out there that I think, I don't know if it's saying exactly the same thing as this, but the idea is that in the most difficult and darkest of moments, it's finding a spiritual connection that can help. Is it easy? Is it doable? Does it feel like it's doable all the time? Maybe not. Maybe it's not easy. Whatever. But the message of this verse is that there's always a connection to be found, and that's what truly soothes the soul. It's not the other stuff that soothes the soul. It's finding this type of connection that really and truly soothes the soul. When the soul is aching, when the soul feels attacked, when the soul feels like it's sold itself out again and again because of the pressures around it, when it feels like, you know, whatever, finding, reclaiming that sense of spiritual dignity and that relationship with God is really the path. You know what? Let's read it inside. Oh, I have the text. Sorry. Let's do this. I have more in the car, I just realized. I'm not going to go get it, though, because we only have a few minutes left. So if you don't mind, take and yet share if you need to. Sorry about that. We may actually have enough. We may have enough. Hey, it's like the Hanukkah miracle. This insight is coming from the Tzemach Tzedek, who's a mystic, great mystic and scholar. Take a look. This is all found in brackets, and like in a parenthetical statement, this entire insight. Page 370. If you don't mind, please turn to 370. You see that the second paragraph in the English says in a similar vein, in the brackets? Yeah? Do I have the right page? 370? Okay. So he says, in a similar vein, the Tzemach Tzedek interprets the verse, for the maiden was found in the field, she cried out, but there was none to save her. As meaning, what does it mean spiritually? That even when the maiden, which is the soul, is found in the field of the forces opposed to holiness, moreover, her being there made it possible for Esav, the man of the field, who personifies the forces opposed to holiness, to take hold of her and lie with her. Nevertheless, even in such a situation, the soul's desire is for holiness. The first statement is, even when the soul ventures out into a spiritually hostile environment, which makes it so much more difficult for the soul to do its soul-y thing, because it's gone out into a spiritually dangerous and precarious place. Even then, and you would say, look what's happening. The person made a choice to abdicate their spiritual values. They've walked away from God. He says, number one, even in such a situation, the soul's desire is for holiness. Even then, when you could say the soul made a choice to disconnect, the soul walked away, said, sayonara, God, I'm out of here. I'm going into the field. See you later. Going to Vegas. Joking. I don't know why Vegas is the field. Man, UFC. Anyway, so the point is like this. So even then, if you don't know the reference, it's better that way. Even then, huh?
You don't support that, do you?
That's hilarious.
That's the field. That's where the forces of Esav. I may or may not. So even then, at the heart of hearts of the soul, the soul's desires for holiness. You can't kill a soul. You can't get rid of the soul's desire, true desire. Even when it looks like the soul has said, I'm out of here, the person has said, I'm out of here, inside their soul still wants higher connection. And it cries out bitterly. Tsaka hanaira. In other words, getting back to the verse, kibasa de matza, even though she's found in the field, and let's say she put herself in the field. This is not the physical case, right? This is a spiritual case. Even though a person turned their back, so it's a harsh term, walked away from their spiritual values and went willingly into another space, even so the soul still retains its integrity, and therefore it's tsaka hanaira, and it cries out bitterly, because Esav, the man of the field, has taken hold of it, of her. It's actually her. Ba is in the Hebrew is feminine. And then, page 371, the outcry of the maiden, the soul, causes Ayin Moshiela. Instead of the phrase being interpreted literally that there is none to save her, it can be understood in a positive manner, the Ayin, the dimension of godliness that transcends all definition, and is therefore called Ayin nothingness because it's so transcendent that you can't use any phrase of description to peg that reality of God. You can't say any box. You can't call God the creator because that puts God into a creative box. And you can't call God even God because that puts God into a God box, whatever that looks like. Right? You can't use any descriptors. The only thing you could say is non-description, beyond description, Ayin nothingness. In other words, this is the essence of God. When the soul is in a difficult place, even if it's due to the choice of a person who put themselves in that place, even in that case, Ayin Moshiela. Number one, the soul cries out. The soul still wants a relationship with God, and it does cry out. And when it cries out, Ayin Moshiela, the dimension of God, godliness that transcends all definition, is therefore called Ayin nothingness, will save her. Which means that deliverance, sounds like a nice, dramatic phrase, Yeshua, which is salvation, deliverance, it's being saved, is drawn down, is elicited for the soul, from the level of Ayin that transcends the spiritual cosmos. And here we have such a powerful, and I believe, uplifting teaching. And that is, no matter where we are, no matter where we've been, no matter what we've chosen, our soul still retains its absolute purity and integrity and remains in a state of desire for a conscious and revealed connection with God. And it cries out. We might not be aware of it, but it cries out for that relationship. That's what it wants. I've said this before. You might have heard me say this before. I believe that one of the reasons why we inundate ourselves with stimuli is to quiet that voice inside that's crying for something deeper. So we say, I don't want to feel that. I don't want to hear that. So let me check my phone. So let me watch another video. So let me distract myself with something else, some other form of entertainment. Let me buy something. I think I said watch something. Whatever. I was thinking, who was I speaking with? I was speaking with somebody about this. Maimonides lived in Egypt. Not always, but for a number of years he lived in Egypt. He was the royal physician. And he wrote a 14-volume work of Jewish law called the Mishneh Torah. 14 thick volumes of law, organized. Oh. We were speaking of this. No word processor. Maimonides. He writes 14 volumes, thick, massive volumes of Jewish law. An encyclopedia of Jewish law, called from the Torah and the Talmud. The Talmud is, it's not a critique, it's just a reality. The Talmud is not so organized. I mean, it's organized by tractate, but you'll find anything in any given tractate. Because the Talmud famously goes off on tangents and brings in things and leaves questions unresolved. And Maimonides picked up all the pieces. And he compiled straightforward, clear work of Jewish law. Organized. Categories, subcategories, sub-subcategories. You know, like when you make an outline and it keeps on getting indented and everything's so clear and organized. Without a computer, without a word processor, without whiteout. Without libraries of books, without resource, right? Without any of this, he created it, and it stands till today, and it's amazing. And I look at it and I say, not only is it amazing, it's a miracle. It's a miracle that anyone could put that together then, 1,000 years ago. It's a miracle. You can't. Now I don't mean literally a miracle, but I mean literally a miracle. It's not like, okay, the splitting of the sea miracle, but it's like, how does somebody do that? One way is that they don't have this. Right? So that's my bridge, that's my connection, right? But I feel like, moving back to the point here, our souls, the core of our souls, deeply desire the connection, our connection, spiritual connection. That's what it wants. And it never loses it. Even when we put ourselves in situations that are not speaking to that truth, that's what our soul wants. And our soul is constantly in pain. I can't say constantly in pain, but if it's not in a good place, if it's not able to exercise its that connection, the soul cries out. And that's what I would call that inner sense of dissatisfaction or angst or a sense of what's the word I'm looking for? A sense of not only just dissatisfaction, but restlessness, a sense of inner restlessness. We have ways to soothe that. We have ways to kind of so that we shouldn't feel that. Is it good to quiet that? I don't think so. When the soul cries out, and there's nothing else that can help the soul, it's then that God steps in. And is it a miraculous salvation of God, or is it just that the soul finally discovers and asserts who it is with a force that has to be reckoned with? I don't know. What I do know is that we're all connected. And this teaching, this magnificent teaching, reminds us that no matter who we are, where we are, or who the other person is, the soul is spiritually connected. And God is always available. Thank you very much for joining me today for Kabbalah and coffee.